Chapter 18. As Elith had anticipated, navigating the sensor network was far more challenging with Eth Amuin than it had been when she'd been by herself. But the Strider frames turned out to play an unexpected role. The solution had occurred to her while she'd been in the midst of explaining how important it was that he follow exactly behind her, moving as she did and stopping when she did. Instead of relying on him, she'd realized she could tether his frame to hers and couple it so tightly as to essentially control both. It was awkward and uncomfortable for Eth Amuin, since he had to learn not to resist the thing forcing his own body to move, but after a few minutes of practice, they figured out how to make it work. After that, it was just a matter of her executing the right steps at the right pace. Unfortunately, there was no way to know whether or not they'd successfully avoided detection. There were no alarms, no flashing lights, nothing to indicate success or failure. As such, once they crossed over the preserve's official border, she untethered Eth Amuin's frame and led him on a meandering path through the wilderness. At times, they took pains to double back or otherwise break up their trail. At others, they dashed breakneck through the wild, covering as much ground as they could. Once they'd put some dozen miles between them and the border, they took brief shelter under a rocky overhang and looked at their options. Now that she had the man, she no longer needed to remain in the region. But to make a quick jump to another part of the planet, there were only three viable destinations: Haravan, Alaness, and Orinus. "Grief," she said, "how well do you know these places?" He briefly surveyed the nav tracker and then shrugged. "I don't go into town all that much, but I wouldn't go to Orinus. They've got friends there." "Your people nearly caught up with me in Haravan," she said. "They might still be looking for me there."
"I told you they aren't my people," he answered. "And what makes you so sure they're looking for you right now?"
She'd been assuming that the detail would be looking for both of them. But they wouldn't necessarily connect his disappearance directly to her. At least, not yet. And now that Eth Amuin had gone missing, clearly his return would be their priority.
"You ever been to Alaness?" she asked. He shook his head. "Too far of a walk."
Elith looked at her nav tracker again, judged the terrain. Of the three locations, Alaness had the fewest of her fingerprints already on it. She nodded. "All right," she said. "We'll head for
Alaness," they both said at the same time.
Eth Amuin smiled. He had rushed the word out in a transparent attempt to make it sound like a mutual decision.
"We make a good team," he added.
"I make a good team," she answered. "You're cargo."
"Even cargo can be helpful if its momentum is in the right direction."
"Then I hope we find a cliff pointing toward Alaness." They left their temporary shelter and pushed hard. But even with the aid of the frames, there was just too much ground to cover to make it before the sun had fully set. A chill air rolled through in the afternoon, promising a cold night ahead. And though they still had daylight to work with, once Elith allowed herself to admit the fact that they were going to have to sleep in the open, she realized the best thing to do as the sun was getting low was to secure a place to camp before the darkness and cold dictated the location. Once more, to his credit, Eth Amuin seemed content to let her take the lead and wasn't troubled by the idea of spending the night in the wilderness. He'd brought along a small heating device that he'd intended to pair with his bedroll. When she saw his gear, she was impressed at its compactness and efficiency. But given the pursuit they were likely under, she knew they couldn't risk leaving him out in the open all night. As uncomfortable as it was, there was only one solution. Unfortunately, it required enduring close proximity with Eth Amuin. They parked the frames and concealed them as best they could with camouflage improvised from nearby limbs and other such matter cast off by the trees. She set up their camp a little distance away in one of the few bare patches that could accommodate her shelter, close enough to keep an eye on the frames, but with a buffer between them in case the Striders should attract any attention.
They ate a quick, cold meal, Elith from her rations and Eth-Amuin from a pouch in his satchel. As night closed in around them, she finally took the step she'd been delaying as long as possible and deployed her shelter. For all the possible configurations of her flexible shelter, it hadn't been created to house more than one. In order to fit both of them inside, she had to expand the base as wide as it would go, which made for a ceiling no higher than 2 feet at its tallest point. It was going to be like sleeping two to a coffin. They stashed their gear just outside the shelter, since they were going to need every available inch of the interior for themselves, and then she had Eth-Amuin crawl in first. He didn't seem to have any intention of running off in the night, but she wasn't about to put him between her and the access panel. Once he was in and situated, Elith slid in alongside him and sealed them inside. Almost immediately, claustrophobia settled upon her. They were practically shoulder to shoulder, with no room to shift apart, and the roof of the shelter was like a hand hovering over her face. She endured the feeling for a time, but then decided to set the entire shelter to transparent. The individual tiles faded, leaving only thin seams where they joined, and the forest reemerged around them, the night sky clear above and framed by the spindled trees. Eth-Amuin made a little noise in reaction. "How marvelous," he said, touching the roof. "It's a mimetic composite," she said. "It has quite a few useful properties." "Interesting," he replied. "But I was talking about the sky."
"Don't you see it every night?"
"Yes, and every night it's marvelous." She turned her attention skyward then, actually looked at it in a way she hadn't since she'd arrived. Her business had been with the Earth of Quell, and that alone had been her focus. Now Elith gazed with him at the gloried field of stars that stood watch over it all. But the awe she used to feel in the face of that resplendence had numbed over the years, and gradually been replaced with a deep melancholy as her perspective changed on what that immeasurable expanse contained and the role she had played in its changing. The stars stretched out above them, heaven's unfolding splendor beyond the limit of human conception, and further still, forever expanding, accelerating. Even with all that the ascendants of humanity had mastered, there were still frontiers they had not reached, nor ever could. But up there, out there too, was a stark reminder of the planets that had died by her hand. The great weight she bore with the death of each world, the burden of each memory followed her and lingered over her no matter where she traveled. And she knew, for all the significance those endings had for her, how inconsequential it all was in the midst of that infinity, how much she suffered, and how little it mattered to the cosmos, as though the absence of a single molecule of water might draw any notice from the sea.
"It's comforting to know that, for all the worlds out there, they're all wrapped in the same fabric," Eth-Amuin said. "Close neighbors in that vastness, and on every one a unique sky offering its own revelation of the infinite. Surely you've seen many. Don't you find them wondrous?"
"Not anymore," she answered quietly. She heard him stir, felt his eyes on her, but didn't turn her head to meet his look.
"You must be immovable, then," he said.
He returned his gaze heavenward, and after a moment said, "I genuinely don't understand how that's possible."
"Consider yourself fortunate."
"I've never considered ignorance a virtue. Perhaps you could enlighten me."
"It doesn't really matter what sky you're under. You're always staring up into the same thing."
"The unknown?"
"A grave."
"Well," he said, taken aback, "that's a cheery thought. I suppose it's true in a way. Life and death are joined up there. A lot more of one than the other."
Here on Quell, in the outermost reaches of the galaxy, the heavens themselves testified to the truth of her perspective. The brilliance of the night sky was banded and clustered, dazzling in one portion of the sky, in the other, blackness prevailed,
dotted here and there with the weak and waning flickers of incomprehensibly remote galaxies masquerading as points of light to her naked eye, or wandering stars, loosed and floating out where even galaxies could not hold together. And for all the light in the universe, she couldn't help but see the darkness continually striving to swallow every last bit. Eth Amuin was quiet just long enough for Elith to start hoping he had decided to go to sleep before he spoke again. "Do you find it as strange as I do that we humans can truly grasp neither the concept of nothingness nor of infinity, when both are so clearly on constant display?"
"Probably not," Elith said flatly.
He chuckled. "I suppose that's too philosophical, amusing for someone so practical-minded."
Elith was deeply weary. Weary from travel and pursuit and the relentless need to plan and calculate every step. She wanted nothing more in that moment than for this man to vanish, or at the very least to shut up. But pushing back against her natural impulses, she realized the unique opportunity this uncomfortable arrangement offered. Forced into such close contact, lying on their backs under the night sky, she could already sense an openness growing between them, one, if she could embrace it, that she might be able to exploit.
"I'm sorry that you think so little of me," she said. "I have actually been in a library before."
Ella thought of the great library of the first house, where she had spent years of her life in study of the human mind and the origins of thought. Though the wilderness felt like her natural environment, her second home was that magnificent storehouse of knowledge and wisdom gathered from the entire known history of humanity and the crown jewel of all such ascendance collections. She wondered what Eth Amuin would say if he had known how deeply she had studied. And more, she wondered what she could draw out of him by engaging with his thoughts.
"Oh, I didn't mean it as a criticism of you. Sometimes I ask questions that lead to nonsense answers."
"It isn't a bad question. I just don't find it all that strange that such concepts escape us."
"Oh, why is that?"
"Because we are defined by our limitations." He grunted at that.
"You disagree?" she asked.
"No," he said, "but I find myself unable to accept it."
"Truth cares very little whether or not we accept it."
"So it would seem."
Elith heard the moment in the quiet that followed, a hesitation on his part. Something reawakened within him. She gently pursued.
"You've suffered under its revelation?"
"Haven't we all?"
"Some more than others."
He laughed without humor.
"If you only knew."
He fell quiet again, but it was active silence. In a normal exchange, the tension would have signaled discomfort, a desire to escape to safer ground. But Elith stayed in the moment, bore the awkwardness, remained present and available, and most significantly, silent. The time extended, stretched, and she feared that the chance for something more had passed, that it had slipped away. But then Eth Amuin spoke again.
"I was reckless in my youth, overzealous. I used to believe it was impossible to damage people with the truth. Or no, that's being too generous to myself. Rather, I thought I couldn't be held responsible for the direction the truth led, that whatever burned up in its fire was not worthy of existence anyway.
And now?
Now? Now I suppose I will simply have to bear the burden of my previously untempered zeal."
"More truths that cannot be spoken?" she said.
"No," he said. "Those were truths that longed to be known. It was just that I was incapable of speaking them, back then. But I have since learned."
He was quiet once more, and she could sense him withdrawing, returning inward. His vague confession had taken him too far, or had stirred memories he now had to contend with. It had made him vulnerable, more so than he had intended, perhaps. And where previously she had assumed she would have to force information from him,
Elith saw now how coaxing it from him might in fact be possible. There hadn't been time to use unwalling the garden on him before. Now they had nothing but time. There was risk, of course, as there always was, in opening herself up to him that way. The communion formed a deep connection, and though she could create some distance for herself, she could not come away from that bonding without being impacted by it. It was a risk she was willing to take. If she was successful, she might well learn here and now all she needed. And if he resisted, then, at the very least, she would have another opportunity to observe his technique and possibly glean something new. She whispered the words to herself, felt the liquid unfolding of her senses. The gentle pressure of his shoulder against hers warmed electric, the sensation of physical contact heightened by the openness she had awakened. She could sense him in a different way now, but not as powerfully as she had expected. He was there, but remote, fuzzy, or rather, her grasp had been blunted, as though she were trying to pick up a small rock from a mountain stream with frost-numbed hands. Eth Amuin shifted, drawing away from her just enough so that their shoulders no longer touched. He glanced at her. "Are you certain you want to do that?" "I want to understand," she said. He rolled onto his side, facing her, laid his head on his arm. And though it was too dark to see much of his features, she could feel the intensity pouring from him. Whatever he was doing, he was preventing her from experiencing the fullness of his being. But it wasn't easy for him to contain. She could feel the struggle. "It's all right," she said. "I don't know that it will be," he replied. "But if you are willing." In the next moment, the wall between them disintegrated, and with it, the fabric of reality. Elith felt herself plunging backward, and a moment later she was flat on her back, not in her shelter, but rather on a drought-stricken plain, cracked and barren, stretching endlessly in all directions. Above her there was no sun, no moon, no sky, only a blank void that somehow seemed empty even of emptiness. And before her stood Eth Amuin. Chaos exploded, an incandescent storm of rage and grief and pain, and love and elation and inexpressible awe. The dead environment around them howled and swirled, a typhoon of vision and experience too intertwined and compounded to process. His being loosed upon her like a subterranean river, shattering its mountain prison, scourging the land in its rush to freedom. It was too much. Not just a lifetime of joy and sorrow, but a legion of lifetimes, layer upon layer, more history than any one human could possibly have lived, more vivid and vital than anything other than personal experience and memory could form. He, like Quell, was an impossibility. A hurricane besieged her, battered her, and the raw energy and violence within him made Elith want to retreat, to hide from the maelstrom that was this man. But she was a servant of the first house of the Ascendants, an advocate of the voice, and Sareth Hanan was her way, the quiet action of she who endured. In the midst of that whirlwind, she stood to her feet. For a time unknown, they strove against each other, he a wildfire, raging and all-consuming, she the mountain beneath, unmoved and unmovable. He was trying to overpower her, to overwhelm her with a flood of the most deeply felt, most jagged emotions within him, anger and fear, yes, but ecstasy too. And at the source of it all, Elith could sense his will, his determination, a purpose made unbreakable in the star-fired forge of his many histories. "You mustn't seek to control it," he said. "Chaos cannot be controlled. Will not be controlled." And then without warning, the storm calmed, the confusion of what appeared to be many possible histories aligned into a single timeline. Eth Amuin's expression shifted, lightened, and he said, "But you can learn to dance with it." He receded from her then, closing himself off to her, though it took effort for him to do so. As he withdrew, Elith felt within him two fleeting sensations,
hurt, and reluctance. Hurt by her attempt to pry him open artificially, reluctant to break off the bond that was forming between them. There was a deep loneliness etched upon his innermost being. She sensed how he longed to be known, to be understood, and to be accepted in spite of the secret truths he bore. There had been something deeper still, buried at the base of that loneliness, a knot of emotion she had not quite been able to touch, but that called to her like a faint echo of a dream half remembered. And then the vision faded, and they were together again in her shelter. "There is a stillness about you that shames me," he said, rolling once more to his back. "Perhaps when I teach you to dance, you could teach me to stand." Elith wanted to reply, but no words came to her. They lay together once more side by side, with Quell's bifurcated sky above them, draped over the world like a veil, untouched by the violent clash of their interior lives. She found herself trembling in the silence that followed, neither from fear nor cold, but rather from some residual emotional aftershock, the lingering sensations haunting her like shadows flash burned onto the walls of her mind. And for as much of Eth Amuin as she had experienced, she wondered what of herself she had imparted to him. Chapter 19. Elith insisted on an early start. Eth Amuin made no complaint, but he was clearly detached. They ate quickly and broke down what little camp they had made. Elith directed her morose companion to get the striders ready while she did her best to obscure the tracks they'd left around the campsite. Eth Amuin had the frames uncovered and moved when she reached him and stood quietly by while she again made an effort to conceal the hiding place. They were on the move before sunrise, navigating the darkened wood at an easy pace with the frames, still covering more ground than they would have had they been on foot, but nowhere near the full capacity of the striders. As they gained light, so too they gained speed. Still, there had been no attempt at contact from the Paragon, and Elith wasn't sure what to make of that. Either her report had been so bad that the Paragon was still scrambling to discern what to do about it, or Elith's proposed plan of action had been good enough that the Matriarch was merely awaiting further word. After 3 hours of travel, Eth Amuin still hadn't spoken a single word to her. He'd only listened and acted as instructed, though at first she was glad for the silence, as it became more apparent that they weren't under direct pursuit. She knew she needed to begin the process of getting him to open up again. It seemed he was still injured from the previous night's interaction. "Living up to your name this morning," she offered. He didn't respond immediately, but after a few moments said, "Which one? Eth Amuin? Or grief?"
"A bit of both."
He went quiet again after that. Elith knew she shouldn't push into waters too deep, but felt if she could keep him talking, it would help him continue to thaw toward her. The first thing that came to mind was a question she'd had from the day before. "I have to ask you something. About Birnan and his frames."
"Yes."
"Did you realize how much of a sacrifice he was making to give them to us?"
"Of course. They're his livelihood. He's the main timber harvester for the collective."
Elith was surprised, both by the revelation of the strider's importance to the collective and by Eth Amuin's casual attitude about having taken them. She'd discerned that the frames were significant to Birnan and his family, but hadn't realized how essential they were to the entire group.
"And you took them anyway?"
"Why wouldn't I? They were offered freely."
"Because you have no intention of returning them.
It wouldn't have been much of a gift if it hadn't cost him anything."
Elith stopped walking and turned briefly to face him, hardly believing what he had just said. But she had nothing to say in return, and his look suggested he didn't understand the strength of her reaction. She turned back around and resumed hiking.
"This bothers you," he said.
Elith waved her hand at him, dismissing it. He'd answer the question.
For all his talk, he had no qualms about using people as he saw fit. But a moment later, Eth Amuin continued, "Let me ask, is it because he offered, or because I accepted? It's because you put him in a position where he had no other choice. What do you mean?" Eleth glanced back at the man, held a hand out toward him in mock reverence. "The god descends from the mountain," she said, "and demands a sacrifice. Either he obeys, loses his means of support and suffers, or he refuses, fails his faith, and suffers."
"You said we needed them.
You asked why it bothered me."
"I suppose you've never had to sacrifice for something greater than yourself."
Eleth spit a bitter laugh.
"Ah," Eth Amuin said, "you disdain him as a lesser being.
I'm sure he's a fine man.
Yet you consider yourself superior."
"Not at all. And it's not about him, it's about you. You say you don't want followers, but you're happy to exploit their obvious devotion." Eth Amuin chuckled. "I don't see what's amusing about that," Eleth said.
"I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at you. I forget that your time on that mountain has been somewhat limited."
Eleth hadn't expected the simple question to open the door so wide and so quickly, but she recognized the opportunity and seized it. She slowed her pace a stride or two, allowing him to close the gap between them, not quite walking side by side, but enough to encourage further conversation. "Maybe you'd like to give me some more context, then, because right now you sound like a sociopath."
"How much context would you like?"
"However much it takes to help me understand."
"So, all of it, then.
You can skip the boring parts."
She glanced at him, caught a glimpse of the fading traces of a brief smile. He was warming. She was on the right path.
"When I first came to Quell, I needed a place of solitude, somewhere I could be alone, to contemplate and reevaluate. The mountain was all wilderness then. But after a while, people found me, as they always do, and a few decided to follow me out there. In the early days, it was a place where everyone was welcome. I never turned anyone away. The only thing keeping people out was their own assumptions, or lack of willingness, or ability to confront the elements. And the mountain can be a harsh place. Not many stayed."
"And those who did?
You taught them how to survive?"
"No,"
he said. "I only taught them how to live."
He left the statement hanging in the air, though Eleth couldn't tell if it was because his mind had taken him somewhere else, or if he was in fact waiting for some kind of response from her.
"Now you sound like a pretentious sociopath," she said.
The laugh that escaped him then was sudden and full-throated, genuine, full of delight, the rolling sort of laughter with a blast radius that sends ripples of mirth through anyone close enough to hear it. Eleth smiled in spite of herself, just from the pureness of the sound.
"I can't remember the last time someone put me in my place," he said.
The burst of laughter was short-lived, but his face retained the glory of it.
"I'd forgotten how good it could feel not to be feared. But what I meant was I didn't teach any of them any particular skills. I only gave them a tool. It was up to them to decide whether or not to make use of it."
Eleth dreaded what he might say next. If he had been teaching his followers his own broken knowledge of the deep language, then that would indeed help explain the state of Quell. But she could scarcely imagine the nightmare that would unfold from that, tracking down all those people he'd come into contact with, investigating what worlds they had traveled to since. It would be the Markovian strain all over again, possibly worse. And that tool was self-reliance, for one thing, he said. Eleth was both relieved and mildly disappointed by the pedestrian answer. As he continued to speak, though, he gradually became more animated and lively, the enthusiastic teacher awakening within him. "All the great evils of our race come from a single root. The fear of lack of food or shelter or love or security.
But when you position yourself in the world in such a way that you can stand facing whatever may come, trusting that whatever happens, you are competent and capable of finding a way through, you are a powerful being indeed. And somehow all of that makes you feel better about taking Birnin's frames?
Certainly. Birnin understands. Radical self-reliance empowers radical self-sacrifice.
Elith laughed then, but humorlessly, scoffing.
Forgive me, she said, but preaching self-sufficiency in defense of literally taking someone else's possessions strikes me as acutely hypocritical.
Yes, well, double standards are the human standard. But let's be precise. I said self-reliant, not self-sufficient. No one is wholly self-sufficient. Can you make the air you breathe, the sunlight that feeds the world? What infant ever fed, clothed, or protected itself? Self-sufficiency is a delusion of the imperceptive or narrow mind, one that either fails to notice or chooses to discount all the gifts that the universe already freely provides. Those gifts exist not by you, nor because of you, but nevertheless are there. For you. The exalted Eth Amuin was now on full display. Elith felt the passion of his beliefs, regardless of whether or not she shared them. And at last, she began to understand the power he held over those he would not call disciples, but who followed him nonetheless. But that's beside the point. You didn't let me finish. There is, in fact, a second piece to the tool. Handle and blade, if you will. Self-reliance is the handle, that which we grip, but the far greater portion of the work comes from beyond its reach. The blade is, well, it is Arinthia, he said, slipping uncharacteristically into the high language. The way he said it, though, impacted Elith more forcefully than normal speech, swelled her heart with the fullness of its meaning. It was something like courageous, boundless optimism, but deeper, with greater confidence. Not mere daydreaming or hoping for the best, but an unshakable faith that regardless of what appeared to be, that which was most needed was close at hand. When people are frightened of lack or scarcity, they cling, they hoard, they abuse. But when they embrace the overwhelming abundance of the world and they believe themselves capable of harvesting it, well, the resilience of such people can hardly be overestimated. And so, he continued, and here he completed his transformation into wandering sage as he emphasized his words with pantomime. In one hand, we must grip tightly ourselves, our natural gifts, our duties, our responsibilities. We must do our part. He stopped walking, took up a pose. The other hand we must leave open, ready to receive that which the universe holds out for us. The truth is that our effort hardly accounts. Our tiny offering is wholly insignificant compared to the abundance before us. And yet, somehow, it remains of cosmic importance that we make it. Elith scarcely heard the final words of the sentence. She was too struck by Eth Amuin's stance, the way he held his body and his hands, one clenched close to his body, the other partially extended, open, palm upraised. It was identical to a pose from her meditation sequence, Watcher Greets the Storm. And not casually so. The angles of his arms, the stance, even the position of his fingers was proper. He saw her reaction and smiled. It had been neither accident nor coincidence. Who taught you that? She said.
I learned it from the same source you did.
I doubt that, she said. It was only after she'd answered that she realized how he had snared her into revealing herself.
Perhaps not exactly the same source, he said. But I didn't mean the first house. The lineage of your instruction traces back to the same origin as mine."
Elith contained the emotion to neither confirm his suspicion nor issue an overly strong denial. She let out a little laugh.
"The first house? I'm not sure whether you mean that as a high compliment or a vicious insult. Why would you think I was one of those gray witches?"
"Oh, I've met some of your kind before. Long ago. I thought perhaps you were Hezra when we first met, but our second meeting was enough to convince me."
The mention of the Hezra struck her. In their first meeting, he'd asked if she had intended to kill him. But if he thought she was a Hezra assassin, then who did he think was protecting him all this time?
"I know the origin of your teachings," Elith said. "We most certainly do not share them."
"Oh, what origin do you believe that to be, then?"
"You're a disciple of Varen Fedic."
He startled at the mention of the name, surprised at her insight.
"I do not deny I have followed the thoughts of that man, but I did not end with them. And I would like to believe I have fashioned something new, something better."
"Then you are a great fool. Nothing good could possibly come from a being with so great a capacity for evil."
"Without such a capacity for evil, how could anyone be good?" he countered.
"If you have no other choice, that doesn't make you good, only weak. You seem convinced of many things that I'm not sure are true," she said.
"And you believe many things that I know to be false, but I can help you correct that."
The deep isolation she'd felt in him came back upon her, fresh in her mind. That was his ultimate vulnerability. He believed he possessed unique cosmic understanding. In her, he had found hope at last of being able to share his experiences with someone who would be capable of understanding them. It was a hope he retained still, though now she sensed that he was at war with himself, questioning her motives and what he could do about them. Or perhaps knowing her motives and hoping he could persuade her otherwise.
"Well, by all means, great teacher," she said with a sarcastic bow. "Enlighten me."
"Gladly. But first you must agree to answer honestly. There's no need to pretend that you are anything other than what you are. It's written on your hands, after all."
He resumed walking then, leaving her once more momentarily stunned. Elith refused the urge to look at her palms. It was true, her identity within the house was etched there, but how he could have perceived it was beyond her. She shook off the surprise and fell in step beside him, watching as he contemplated for a few moments.
"What would you say you hold to be most deeply true?" he said. "What is your ultimate foundation?"
"The word alone," Elith answered, both honestly and reflexively.
"The true speech?"
"The deep language, yes."
"Ah, the deep language,"
he said, testing the words in his mouth. "I hadn't thought of it that way before, but yes, that makes sense. The deep language. I like that."
"So," he continued, "the word alone, you say, is your foundation, not the first house of the ascendants?"
Elith felt at once that he had discerned the crack deep in her soul, the one left by her failure to put Quell down, the one she'd tried to deny, but that lingered still.
"They are one and the same," she answered.
"Oh, interesting," he said. "Would you say your knowledge of the deep language is complete and perfect?"
"No."
"Then what is it that you believe that you know to be wrong?"
"I wouldn't believe something if I knew it was wrong."
"Then your knowledge is perfect."
"Of course not."
"So you admit that you must be wrong about some things that you hold true, and yet you are uncertain which things those are?"
"I will grant you that," she said, "but only for the sake of argument."
"Thank you. That's very gracious of you. I don't mean to make it personal. So for the sake of argument, how best might one discover which of one's beliefs are incorrect?"
"By testing them, I suppose."
"And if one is not allowed to test them?"
Then one, I imagine, is destined to be wrong forever.
And when was the last time you questioned what you'd been taught by the first house?
Elith checked herself here. She'd almost said often, but for an instant she wondered if the truth was closer to never.
It cannot hurt to ask the question, Alaya, he said, putting sarcastic emphasis on the name he knew to be fake, even of things you believe deeply. If they are true, they will withstand the question. And if not, then you can emerge stronger, no matter how difficult the passage into truth may be. Doubt is a powerful guide and the beginning of wisdom.
And you are, what, at the end, I suppose?
Me? Oh, no, I'm still at the beginning, too, he said with a smile. But it is the beginning of infinity, so I don't expect my progress to be all that noticeable.
And is that what you're after? Wisdom alone?
No, he said. No, not that alone.
What then? What is it that you want?
To break every chain, he said.
The smile faded, and he looked intently into her eyes.
Many are bound who call themselves free.
The accusation was clear. He thought she was merely a slave to the first house. A necessary condition for freedom is its limitation, she answered. Promises of unlimited freedom are just another road to the tyranny of the powerful. He smiled again at that, genuine, as though she'd passed some sort of test.
Perhaps you see why I envy you so. You have learned so much and are still so young, he said. And I do envy you, Alaya.
Then you are an even greater fool than I thought, she answered.
I don't know what I have that you would envy.
Discipline, he replied,
and focus. I've had to learn so much on my own. My understanding is haphazard,
incomplete.
It took me decades to discover things you were probably taught in a day. And you are so precise, calculated in everything. I am in awe of your stillness. I think it will be easier for you to become more like me than I to become more like you.
I don't want to be any more like you than absolutely necessary.
Oh? Then why are you following me now?
Eth Amuin looked at her for a moment with his sunlit smile, then glanced around and pointed off to the mountain range they were leaving behind.
Some look there and see the mountains. A barrier, a boundary, a sign saying, "Thus far may you come and no farther." Others look over the same majestic view and see beyond the wall to the horizon, a thing to be pursued and sought after. It is the right of humankind to test themselves against those barriers and in time to break through them.
Or be destroyed upon them, Elith said.
Tell me, what is it that the first house was established to do?
We serve.
We watch.
We contemplate, Elith answered.
Occasionally we speak.
That is what you do now, perhaps, he said. But it is not the purpose for which your house was originally created. It was once a catalyst for growth. But now it is a deterrent, an oppressor.
Elith had to stop herself from letting loose her deep offense at such a misrepresentation of all that the first house stood for. They were protectors, not tyrants.
I'm a servant of order, she said calmly.
You're an agent of stasis, and that puts you in the same league as death.
Wouldn't you rather stand with me, on the side of life? His tone said more than his words alone. He was hinting at having discerned her mission to quell.
I know what you came here to do, he said, but I'm not yet confident you'll do it when the time comes.
For all he seemed to have learned about her, he had failed to perceive that which should have been most obvious, her resolve.
And yet, Elith said,
You'll teach me what you've learned anyway?
In time, yes.
Even if you believe I'm your enemy?
He continued walking, but with his hands he again made the pose of watcher greets the storm.
My part. I hope that once you understand the universe as I do, you'll want to engage with it the way I do. But I have no control over that. We may be adversaries at the end of it all, but I'm willing to take the risk because of what could be if we were allies.
And what would that be?
He thought for a moment, scratched the side of his face.
There is an ancient story, he said.
A man goes to a market and encounters a seller of arms, weapons, armor, all the various tools of war appropriate for the age, and an elegant spear catches the man's eye, so he inquires of the seller, saying, "Tell me, sir, this spear, is it of quality?"
"Sir," the seller answers, "I tell you truly, it is of the highest quality known to mankind. Its head is keen beyond measure, its shaft as strong as the mountains. There is neither helm nor shield nor breastplate that can withstand the unstoppable force of its strike."
"An impressive piece to have on display," the man says, and continues to browse. A few moments later, he finds a stout shield, graven with images and polished like the moon. "This shield," he says, "is it also of such high quality?"
"Sir," the seller replies, "I speak without deceit when I say that it is the very pinnacle of workmanship and the height of design. Its balance does not weary the arm, yet it turns aside any blow as easily as a fortress wall. Truly, there is no blade, spear, or axe in existence that can slash, pierce, or cleave this immovable shield."
"Ah," the man says, "then I am in a quandary, for I do not know whether I should purchase from you your unstoppable spear or your immovable shield. Clearly, at least one must be counterfeit, since both cannot possibly exist."
"Not so, good sir," answers the seller. "For the man who wields them both needs never fear the impossibility of their clashing."
After he'd finished the story, Eth Amuin turned to her and asked, "What do you make of that?"
"I'd say that was a clever salesman."
"Indeed. But a wise man would purchase them and so become invincible.
More likely a fool, made poor by his reckless spending, and soon after dead by testing his purchases in battle."
"Well, yes, but it's a fun story anyway, and I think we're that pair, you and I. That means there are only two possible outcomes. Either one of us must prove false in the end, or, standing together, we both hold true, and the purpose that unites us may yet stand."
What purpose in that man's mind could possibly unite them, she wondered.
Only one that she could foresee. Breaking what he perceived as the chains of the ascendants, wielding the power of the deep language to burn it down and start anew. There was no way they would ever stand together. But she didn't need to let him know that yet.
"Which one am I?" she asked.
"What do you mean?
The spear or the shield?"
He chuckled. "I'm not sure yet."
Eth Amuin had opened up so much to her. She knew that with a little more time and careful effort, she could lead him into revealing his actual knowledge or methods. But as they crested a rolling hill, the sound of an approaching skimmer grew behind them, and they were forced to scramble for cover. The vessel passed by some distance to their left. When they emerged from hiding and continued a little farther on, Elith recognized the first signs of Alaness appearing ahead of them. Further lessons would have to wait. This close to civilization, she needed all her attention focused on her surroundings. Like most cities, Alaness's transit stations were arranged around its perimeter. As they closed in, Elith identified the most secluded approach to the city, and from there, a path to the nearest station. The day was fading by the time they reached it, and as was Elith's way, they remained some distance removed to give her a chance to observe and evaluate.
"Guess we're clear," Eth Amuin said. "Looks like no more officers than usual."
"Maybe to you," Elith answered. But there's one, she said, pointing to a plain-clothed woman seated by a window near the main entrance to a cafe. And there. And there.
They all just look like people to me.
Then it's a good thing I'm here.
I never argued otherwise, he said. Seems a lot more crowded than I would have expected, though.
It was true. Small transit stations like the one they'd located tended to get backed up, particularly toward the end of the day. This number, however, seemed large even for that. They remained outside for a long while, and it eventually became clear what was happening. Skimmers and larger transports were arriving, but in all the time they watched, not a single one had departed. They'd locked the station down, Elith said finally. Strider frames weren't unheard of within city limits, but wandering down the street in them would draw a great deal of attention. According to her map, there was another transit station a few miles farther north and east. They backed out and circled wide around the perimeter of the city. By the time they reached the second transit station, though, they didn't need to observe for long to determine that it, too, had been descended upon by the local authority.
Would they go to all this trouble just for you? She asked.
For me, Eth Amuin said, shaking his head. The detail tends to be a bit more subtle than that. They do have people in the authority, of course, but not nearly enough to exert that kind of influence. And what would the authority care if I'm out wandering the planet anyway?
She scanned the area with her monocular. Given her previous infiltration of the authority's HQ, she had to wonder if the authority was using the lockdown as a mechanism to find her. Either way, they weren't getting out through Alaness. She was still processing that fact when Eth Amuin abruptly laid his hand on her shoulder.
We have to go, he said, right now.
Elith lowered her monocular and turned toward him, but didn't need to ask what had caused his reaction. She saw them now, too. A group of four men were filtering toward them through the woods, aided by a sleek scout drone hovering just above the trees. Without a word, Elith took off north and west, with Eth Amuin by her side and a force of unknown size close behind.